God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. Tonight we're going to kick off on page 79, into action, and a man who needs no introduction, Tim.
Thank you, David. I'm recovered alcoholic named Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to see all of you still here. I haven't chased you all away. That's wonderful. Once again, the disclaimer that this is my experience, strength, and hope with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, known as the Big Book. I do not speak for AA, though at times I do sound that way. And to that end, I apologize in advance. Like David said, we're on 79, which is close to the end of step 8, which is about... I made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And we've read some of the situations and practical solutions to those situations so far. And if you recall, it says, back on page 66, it says, we have a list of all persons we have harmed and became willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So that says that we did our 8th step. If we did our 4th step inventory correctly, we have it. And, you know, being a lazy alcoholic, I'm excited about that, you know. Oh, you mean I did the assignment ahead of time? That's always exciting. So that's that. So we left off the first full paragraph on page 79. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. And then Bill gives us a little nudge again, and he says, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink of anything. And to me, that's just a really wordy way of restating step one. That, you know, if we are to quit drinking, there must be no reservations of any kind, nor any lurking notions that one day we'll be immune to alcohol. So if I'm shrinking at something, it means I have a reservation that, well, I'll do this and I'll do that, but I'm not going to do this. I can never do that. And inevitably, I've always found that any time that I'm balking at doing something that I know is the right thing to do because it's going to be personally injurious to me, it generally ends up being more painful as it goes on. And then I'm like, oh, God, I really got to do this. And then I go and I talk to my sponsor and I start ranting about all the emotions that are going on with me. And this is unfair, that's unfair. And he's like, well, what's going on with you? You know, and I'll have to tell this story. And he'll kind of point out, well, do you see, you need to take care of that. I'm like, oh, man, I knew you were going to say that. And it's usually something that I don't want to take care of. Or it's something that... It's generally fear-based, you know. It's something that I think I'm going to lose that I think I deserve, or you know, something I'm not going to get that I think I should have. And generally, that's usually what I'm clinging to and shrinking at. So and he goes on. And he says, usually, however, other people are involved. So that's usually my caveat. Well, if I do this, this person may be affected, you know, because I could spin that in my head anyway. Because obviously, if I'm doing something. Generally, there's always another person involved, and so I can say, well, that will hurt them, you know. But I've found that there's always ways of making amends to people where other people may be involved that I don't necessarily have to bring them into it or include their part in my amends to kind of lighten my load, because that's just not fair. Remember, we read that rule earlier, you know, that rule. There are no rules in AA, but we have one written. So then he says, therefore, we are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit, which is what I just said. He tells a little story. A man we know had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. Imagine that. Right? She was furious. Rightly so. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, and was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, here I am. We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary. But if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested that he write his first wife, admitting his fault and asking forgiveness. Now, right there, I've heard so many times, and it used to drive me crazy that I wanted to either throw a book or a chair across the room at the person who said it. And it was usually somebody who never read this book, because they say an obvious thing, nowhere in the big book does it say we ask for forgiveness or apologize. Right? And I just read it. Right? He suggested that he write his first wife admitting his fault and asking forgiveness. So I walk up to the person, I said, did you read page 79? No. I said, well, then stop saying what you're saying, because you're wrong. And you're like doling out information about Alcoholics Anonymous that doesn't exist. You know, and unfortunately, a lot of times that's attached to somebody with lots of years of recovery. So it gives credence to what they're saying. It's generally preceded by, you know, I've been sober for 20 years, and nowhere in the big book does it. It's usually followed that way. And for me, that's so dangerous because, you know, when we read and how it works, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, okay, so this is what they said they have. So that's what I want, and that's what I try to pass on myself. So, and I think it's also dangerous because, to me, not asking for forgiveness for something that I obviously did wrong, because it's on a list that I said I was willing to make amends for, is obviously a reservation. And it's going to lead me back to, oh, trying to ignore it, and then, like, going back into that insanity of, no, that's I don't really have to do that because, you know, she was blank, and you know, and that's why we got divorced, and she cheated on me, or whatever the situation may be. It becomes that justification that allows me to keep doing what I'm doing, you know. So it's important to point that out for me, anyway. And then he says he did, and also sent a small amount of money. So right away he was sending a letter asking for forgiveness, and without even asking what sort of amends that he needed to make, because he already knew. Here he started to make the amends, so that was like showing that he was moving in that direction. And he told her what he would try to do in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course she did not, and the whole situation has long since been adjusted. Now, I have heard of stories where people went to jail. You know, so to me, you know, the first paragraph on page 80 is really what we have to look at, which is why it's real important to have a sponsor, somebody who's not emotionally affected by the situation, who's clear, who can gather all the facts and information about a particular situation, and say, well, like Richie had asked me a question last week about how would you make amends to somebody, and I didn't, you know, I don't have that experience in my life. So to me, it would just be me being know-it-all. Just, well, this is what you should do. And well, why would I do that? Because that may be leading somebody down the wrong path over my ego. Well, he asked me, you know, like, and to me, that's just not the right thing. I can't live my life that way, you know. So it says on page 80, it says, before taking drastic actions which may implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, oh, look at this, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. Okay, so there's a lot of instruction there. So, obviously, if there's something that's involved, and to me, the thing always comes to mind with crimes, that, you know, that's my experience. You know, I've had to make amends where crimes were involved, and reparations had to be made, and there were other people involved in it. But, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they didn't have a program, it wasn't their problem, it was my thing that was bothering me, I don't know how they felt about it. And I would go ahead and I would do it. I would let them know, listen, you know, I'm going to take care of this, and I'll keep you out of it. And they're like, okay, well, you better. I'm like, listen, I just told you I'd keep you out of it. That's the end of it. As far as I'm concerned, it's singular. So they're like, all right, that's fine. You know, so I did what this was just saying to me. And then it's having consulted with others. My sponsor, the first one. And then, like a perfect example, we go back to that example. If I'm sponsoring somebody through this process and they ask me, well, you know, this is what happened in my life, and I killed somebody, and what should I do about it? And I say, well, I don't know, because I haven't been there. But I do know somebody. Let me talk to them and ask if they can, you know, if I could pass their number on to you, and then you could talk to them personally, and maybe they'll have some good advice for you. And, you know, and that's how I try to handle it, because I don't generally want to say, well, I know this guy so-and-so, and he did this, and he said that, because I may get it wrong. I may be telling the wrong story. Or maybe that person, you know, because the second A in AA is anonymous, doesn't want me passing on that information about their life to other people. You know, it's like I talked about at the beginning of the process, like, or the fifth step when we talked about that. If I'm going to somebody saying, listen, I need to tell you about what's going on with my life, Now they have that information, and like let's say somebody comes to me and gives me their information, and then I'm sponsoring somebody else, and this person I sponsored through that they did that, and then now I'm not keeping their confidence, and I'm they're telling me their stuff, and I'm going, hey, so and so said this, and then this guy I sponsored, so and so, he did this, or this woman that I know, she did this, it's just not right, and I'll end up getting implicated in all this stuff, and that's just a mess. So for me, to me, the most important four words of it is ask God to help. Ask God to help, because for me, it always comes down to that feeling that's inside. I don't know about anybody else. I always talk about this. When I'm about to do something wrong that may implicate somebody or may hurt somebody, there's always that small voice that tells me it's a bad idea. Or that feeling I have that, this doesn't seem right. To me, that's usually God, pushing me in a direction. Because if we recall back, lack of power is my dilemma. The best I can do is drink and get drunk. So if I don't have that higher power in my life, I'm always going to go towards the wrong direction. I'm just kind of a bit like my, the shopping cart that has the bad wheel. I'm always just going to go left on it. So I need God to kind of pull me and my shopping cart in the right direction to do the right thing. So I always have to have God in what I'm doing. Right? And then if all of that goes well and we have to do this, okay, then I know that I have to kind of have a serenity prayer going on. I have to pray for that courage to do whatever it is, that strength, and not shrink, right? So then it gives another story, an example. This brings to mind a story about one of our friends. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received the money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, his rival was ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? So those are really important questions. Because obviously, for me, fortunately or unfortunately, I'm a single man. So a lot of things that I do in my own personal life, I don't have that kind of implication. I don't have to, if I screw up, I screw up, and I can go and take care of it right away. Which is kind of freeing. So there isn't, and especially when it comes to financial and monetary things, because I don't have to pay for somebody else's stuff. I don't have children's education that I have to pay for, meals, those sorts of things. I wasn't blessed with that. So I at least have that. So once again, it comes down to, if somebody is in those situations and they come to me and say, well, what should I do about this? I'm going to, because I collect people's experiences and their stories for such occasions and such purposes, because I know I'm not going to have the answer to everything. I like to think that I do, but certainly I'm just not going to. So I'm able to try to run through my filing cabinet of people's experiences and how they deal with things. And I can say, well, let me get back to you. I know this person. Let me talk to them. They may have something. And it's the same thing. So I have this wonderful pool of experience of people who have gone through this process. I said, oh, you did that? Oh, okay. And even I do that in my situation. I'll say to people, hey, do you know anything about this? And they say, oh, yeah, I know about this. And or maybe I know somebody who is in a particular line of work. And I'll ask them about, I say this all the time. I'm not going to ask somebody who's divorced four times about marriage. Because they don't know. If I'm going to get divorced, that's my guy. I'm going to him. Okay? I'm going to go to somebody who's, solid and, and maybe there may be somebody that I think is solid, but I really don't know much about their relationship. So they may say, oh, I don't know anything. But you've been married 28 years. Yeah, but, the last 26 of them have been bad. That's true. Somebody said that to me. So I'm like, oh, wow. So my perception could be off also. But at least they were honest enough to say, oh, I don't know, and sent me somewhere else. So it's really important to look at those types of things and sit right with them. Because, the key there is, he said, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner. So if it's fear-based, obviously God's not in it. We talk about that. If you're in fear, there's no faith. If you're in faith, there's no fear. It's kind of really cool how that works out. Right? So then here's the solution. After consulting with his wife and partner, the two people that would be implicated, right, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his creator guilty of such ruinous slander. So ultimately, his feeling about how God was more important than his partner and his wife. So that's kind of, I don't know how that worked, but that's how it did, according to them. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again and all would be lost anyhow. So that just kind of reiterates that first step of the reservation. If I don't do this, I'm going to go back to drinking. Right? He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His action met with widespread approval, and today he's one of the most trusted citizens of his town. This all happened years ago. So that's nice. That's a nice happy ending. You know, fortunately, through the stories that they tell, you know, they give us happy endings to these stories. But, you know, there's lots of stories that work out like this, and there's no happy ending. You know, I talk about that all the time. That, you know, I know God was in it because I got what I wanted. You know, and it's like, well, what about when it doesn't work out and you don't get what you wanted? Is God still in it then? You know, so for me, those are the ones that are more important for me. The chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could you be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the, quote, girl who understands, unquote. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? Now, I think it's funny that he says that, that he writes that. In fairness, we must say she may understand. You know, it's kind of like a little self-confession there for anybody who knows some history about Bill. Mm-hmm. Or written history, I should say. A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Now, obviously, we could turn that around and change the gender, because that does go on as well. I've experienced that. I've had women tell me those types of things in their life. And it's important to put that out there because, for me, you know, I'm really bad with women. I don't really understand their feelings and emotions and stuff like that. So it's real important that I think women should certainly communicate those things with other women honestly and not be judgmental about it. Just like my experience is that men aren't as judgmental. Oh, yeah, I did that too, yeah. It's all right. And, you know, we go through that process and we get that relief. Oh, somebody else did that thing that I did. And, you know, and my experience has been that there are women who tell me, like, oh, I talked to this is my sponsor, and you know, she doesn't understand where I'm coming from because I did all these things, and she looks at me like, oh my God, how did you do that? I'm like, well, don't worry. Like, go and find other women because there's other women who have done that kind of thing. They're in AA. You know? So it's important for me to point out that it's kind of, it works the other way too. Okay? And he says, whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done. Oh, wait a minute. What's that say? We are sorry for what we have done. Oh, apologizing again. God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take. And he continues to go on with that line, and he says, our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealousy. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. You know, and to me, that's really a key element to that. And, you know, when I was married, there was plenty of people who had opinions about my marriage and my relationship with my ex-wife. And they were more than happy to tell me, unsolicited. And, you know, and that drove me away from meetings for about 5 years. Because I got tired of it. I got tired of that abuse of like, well, you're going to do this, and you know, because they were projecting their own experiences of their own marriage or whatever it was onto mine. And I felt like, well, who are you to say that about me and my wife? And, you know, like, I'm coming to you for some help, and you're giving me your feelings and opinions. Like, I'm not coming to you for help, and you're giving me your feelings and opinions, and I don't remember asking you, you know? And so there's a lot of that. So to me, it is very important that, you know, where he said, no outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. And my opinion, Tim's opinion, is that, you know, it really should be between husband and wife, or boyfriend, girlfriend, or living mates, or partners, or however it is, you know, because, I don't know, to me that goes back to the same thing as like the sex ideal and the sex situations. That's not for other human beings to judge, to me. That should be between two partners. That's my opinion on it. And then he says, if it may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, so we have more instruction, right? Having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with that most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than a face-to-face combat. So again, he's just really laying out some tactful information here. And then, so somebody goes, if we have no such complication, there's plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us may have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. I hear that all the time, in you know, shared in meetings. You know, I'm a winner because I didn't drink today. You know, and that's going to, in the next paragraph, be addressed. You know, the only thing he needs to do is keep sober, and I've heard that too. Your job is to stay sober. That's it. That's the only thing you need to do. Whew, wow, because that's not what that says. You know, it says there's other things that need to be done, lots of them. So then he goes on to say, and I always like this, because this doesn't just apply to active alcoholics. It applies to myself, who is a recovered alcoholic as well. And it says the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Now, I could do this completely sober. Sober. Remember, we talked about the definition of sobriety. It's the absence of alcohol or mood or minor altering substance. It's not qualified. You know, it's I can't say, well, I'm not really sober. You know, because even though my behavior may be bad and I may be doing bad things, as long as I'm not drinking or doing drugs, I am sober. I just may not be spiritually fit. So that's an important thing, right? He says, hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. And then he just really point blank, he states, we feel a man is unthinking when he says sobriety is enough. So there's some proof against those statements of, you know, all I have to do today is stay sober. I'm a winner if I didn't drink today. Well, he says we feel a man is unthinking when he says that. So if he's unthinking, okay, well, so I don't know. I have a tendency to back up from people who are like that. You know, just because it's unsafe for me, because that's infectious for me. Oh, well, he's doing those bad things, and he's getting away with it, she's getting away with it, why shouldn't I? Well, they may have more latitude. Their higher power may have given them a lot more mistakes than I'm going to have. Or, you know, I don't know. I just know that if I drink again, I ain't coming back here unless I have a gun. You know, that's just me, right? Then he says, well, he's like the farmer who came out of the cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Any grand the wind stopped blowing? Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. You know, instruction. A remorseful mumbling, oh, we're sorry, won't fit the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. So there he talks about it again, analyze. To think deeply about something, to break it down, right? Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. Now, I know in my case, a lot of the defects of my ex-wife, it came from me in certain instances, and how I would react. You know, I've heard quite often. Now, I don't like to excuse it because of it just doesn't sit right with me. But more often than not, I've heard, "Well, I lied to you because I was afraid you were going to get mad." Okay, so as much as that may annoy the hell out of me, there's got to be some element of truth in that. Now, their lies are their stuff. Okay, they have to deal with that on their own. However, I have to recognize, like, okay, is there an element of that? Like, am I being rigid and unapproachable that the truth would be received so poorly that I have forced this person to hide the truth in order to feel safe and secure and comfortable and peaceful? And if that happens all the time, it can't always be them. And if it is always them, then I gotta go. You know, those are the choices I have to make. So I have to look at that. And I've experienced that. So it is important for me to look at, you know, like, and on the other side of it, I also qualify for our, as they say, our sister fellowship, and have qualifiers of other alcoholics who were in my family and friends that my behavior was as the result of their behavior. Because that's just a natural flow of things. You know, if I ask a question and I'm constantly lied to about something, I'm going to be suspicious. That's just a natural human thing. You know, so it becomes like, okay, they did that, I'm going to protect myself. You know, and I did that growing up. Like, and I had that feeling. I was afraid to tell the truth to my father because I was afraid of how he was going to react and I was going to get hurt. So that's natural, right? So if I'm doing that, wow, that's a lot of stuff there. That's a big mishmash. Because if somebody is saying that to me, well, that's saying to me internally that I'm just exactly the way my father was. I'm creating that tornado. I'm roaring through the lives of this person. I'm breaking their heart. That sweet relationship is dead. It's uprooted. So now I need to step back and go, oh my God, am I really responsible for this? Or is it this person? And so then I need to, again, consult with my sponsor, put things down on paper, drop back, all this stuff, you know, and really take a look at that. It's important for me. Right? So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. Okay, so there's some instructions for morning prayer. You know, what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to pray. Right? And he says, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness will make a skeptic out of anyone. And that was certainly my experience in my family. And even today, you know, it's been a long time since I drank or had any food or mind-altering chemicals, but, you know, sometimes throughout my sobriety, my behavior or how I was acting was certainly askew and was not on a great spiritual level. So my family still reacts that way. My mother, my sisters, you know, and it becomes like a thing of like, well, you did this, and it's like, that was 7 years ago. Now, I'm not going to continue to apologize for something that went on 7 years ago. I've amended that behavior. I've asked what sort of corrective measures can be made. I've done that. And if there's a continuation of you know, I have choices today. I could say, listen, I'm not doing that. And I could get up and leave. Or I could say, if you're going to continue to do this, I'm not coming. You know, there's those types of things. Because it's important that you know, through this process, if indeed my behavior has changed, if I am living a spiritually fit life, if I am amending old behaviors, you know, it's my past, and nobody else has the right to beat me up with my past. That's what I've learned. You know, that's important. It's really important for me, right? And it doesn't matter if they change. That's what I've learned also. Okay, then it goes on to say, there may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile scraping. I just talked about that, right? As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. So that's also a lot of consultation with sponsors, as far as I'm concerned. You know, because I could say, well, I'm being sensible and tactful. And my sponsor could say, no, you're not. You're just avoiding something that you need to be facing. And then I'll probably get into an argument with my sponsor and say, no, you don't understand. Yeah, I know, but you don't understand. Those are my favorite words. Seven words. I can't say to Tim. And so to me, it's important that I constantly say, all right, well, if I'm off my spiritual beam, if I'm not feeling right emotionally, generally there's something wrong with me. It can't be the rest of the world all the time. If it were, I'd be constantly writing my resentments all the time, right? Okay, and then we get to the nine-step promises. Right? If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. That's important there. Painstaking. If we are painstaking, taking pain, it requires pain. This process requires pain. I'll say it again. This process requires pain. It's like working out. I can't just go to the gym, join the gym, and be thin. It requires pain. Lots of it. That's why I'm fat. Because it's painful. I don't want to go. No, I don't want. I've lost 30 pounds. I put it back on. It was more fun putting it back on, I'll tell you that. And a lot less painful. Right? So, you know. And it really applies to that. And it talks about it before we're halfway through. So basically, you know, we're at the ninth step. So before we're halfway through means before we hit five, we're going to be amazed. I don't know about anybody else, but anytime I've taken somebody through this process, they are. They sit across from me amazed by the third step, usually. They say that prayer, the third step promise comes true for them, and now they're amazed. And they have this glow in their eyes, and they're lit up, and they kind of like, you know, that you see them like on fire, and you're like, oh, wow, cool, we got one. We got one for the cult. You know, no, really. But it becomes this thing of like, cool, they're ready to go. And then I could launch them into that vigorous action. Because it's vigorous action, and I always equate it to working out, vigorous action. Okay, I'm ready. I went to join the gym. I paid my fee. I'm ready to go. And I can't just show up and look at the equipment. I can't just, hey, that's an elliptical machine. Cool. No, I got to get on it. And I got to do it. I have to work a program of getting thin, just like I got to work a program of recovery. Right? So then it goes, he says, we're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. New is the key in there. Because if you're anything like me, freedom was drinking the way I wanted to drink without anybody bothering me about how I was drinking. As soon as somebody said, are you done yet? Are you drunk yet? How many are you going to have? I was not free at that point. On that side of it. And then on the even more deep side, it had a hold of me. It was my master. It told me when to go to bed. It told me when to get up. It told me what to do all the time. It told me what to do with my money. It was that. You know, I was a slave to alcohol. And I certainly had a bondage of self. It was all about me. I wasn't much, but I was all I thought about. Okay, so it was there. So when I went through this process and got fifth step promises that happened and fourth step and third and all this wonderful stuff going on, I was free. That was new freedom. And I started to understand happiness. Because to me, happiness was having enough alcohol to make me numb. That was true. You know what was made me happy? This is great. This is a story. I was in Home Depot the other day, and I saw this woman standing there. I'm going, she looks familiar. Because I never forget faces. Names I forget, but faces I never forget. I'm looking at her, And finally I said, hey, did you work here? And she looked at me. She says, yeah, that was a long time ago. I said, yeah, about 22 years. Because she worked at the place that I used to go to on a regular basis, underage, to get my alcohol. Right? So there's standing in front of me. The thing that made me happy And that I knew I was different than my fellows was that when I drank, I don't know if they still have them, they had beer balls, which was like 2.5 cases of beer, and you had to have a tap, right? And you could rent the tap. Well, I owned the tap, and that made me happy. I owned a tap. I owned a beer ball tap. It was me. So if somebody, my buddies wanted to get a beer ball, I was always for that. Oh, yeah, get one. Because I knew I had the tap. So that entitled me to drink for real. I got the tap. Okay, and that made me happy. Right. So when I went through this process, this painful process of uncovering, discovering, discarding, getting rid of all this crap in my life, purging all that stuff that I had swallowed in my fourth step and going through this process, I knew a new happiness. It was new. It wasn't that happiness. It was like, oh, wow, I care about another human being. Oh, how'd that happen? So I knew those things. That was a promise that came true. This is, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I don't know about anybody else. I regretted everything. I definitely wanted to shut the door on it. I didn't want to know anything about that. I don't anymore. Because I know it's the thing that keeps me helping other human beings. I mean, it's the greatest possession that I have. My darkest past. Not my assets. Not all my accomplishments. All the crap in my past, and sometimes in my most recent past, is fodder to be able to help another human being. That's an amazing thing. That's a gift to me, right? We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. Now, for me, I comprehended serenity. I knew what it meant. I understood it. Okay, and it took me 9 years. 9 years of recovery to know peace. 9 years. I don't know about anybody else, but 9 years it took for me. Because I remember on the day that I celebrated my 9th sober anniversary, I was at peace. Everything about me and my world at that day, I was in this feeling that I'd never felt before in my life. And the woman that I was dating at the time looked at me and she said, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And I said, "Nothing. Absolutely nothing." She says, "Yeah, you look it." Because I did. I mean, the world could have exploded and I would have been okay with it. Oh, that's all right. And that's how I felt. I knew peace. For the first time, I knew peace. It was really cool, right? Then he says, "No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others." I could see that. "That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear." I don't feel useless. I certainly don't pity myself. There are times that I wish I had more money or whatever. You know, things that, you know, worldly clamors. But I say this all the time. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to be me. I wanted to be anybody else on the planet but me. And today, there is nobody else on this planet I'd rather be than me. Nobody. And that's that right there. That's these promises. That's this process. Nobody else. You know, maybe somebody for an hour. You know? But overall, I mean, I love being me. That's a gift of this program, right? We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. It's funny, there's a promise meeting, right? And that they talk about that, you know, like each of the nights, because they call them the promises meeting. And it's like, well, which ones? Because we've read a whole bunch of them before we got to this one. But they're generally talking about the 9-step promises. And somebody actually has to speak on self-seeking will slip away. Which I think, well, talk about the irony of that. How am I going to speak about my self-seeking slipping away? You know, that's just, it doesn't make any sense to me. I just think it's ironic, right? Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. That's really cool. I've experienced that. I'm not afraid of people. I'm not. I'm not afraid of people at all. I'm not afraid of economic insecurity. I've had that for a long time. So I don't fear it at all. I know how to deal with economic insecurity. I think I would probably fear economic security at this point in my life. But this is amazing, right? We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. Right? How about that? Oh, I got a flat tire. What am I going to do? We'll change the tire. Oh, why didn't I think of that? I mean, I don't know about anybody else, those kind of things used to baffle me. Oh, my phone bill, my phone's off. Well, why? I didn't pay the bill. Well, why don't you go pay the bill? I don't know. Not, like, simple little things. Does anybody else ever experience that? Like, things that used to baffle me. Oh, my God, how do I get up on time? will set your alarm. Really? That works? You know, things like, I intuitively know how to handle those things. I mean, they're thoughts that I don't really give much thought to. That's intuition. You know, reflexive thoughts. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Now, I tell this story all the time. It took about 18 months in Alcoholics Anonymous before I had one day of not thinking about drinking. That was suddenly realizing that God was doing for me what I couldn't do myself. Suddenly. I went, oh, well, you know, those moments, those, wow, oh, wow, those God shots, those God moments, right? Then he says, are these extravagant promises? Now, I wish there were three words that he changed in this book, you know. And I say it whenever they say it in meetings. It says, are these extravagant promises? And it says, we think not. And I always say, hell yes. They are extravagant promises to me. Because I couldn't imagine these promises coming true in my life. Couldn't imagine it. They were like, I'm going to be King Midas. They might as well have told me. That was extravagant. And then he says, then he gives us ultimate, like, promises of the promises. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Another guarantee. Another guarantee. If we work for them, they will materialize. Kind of like working out. If I work out, I'm going to get thin. Really? How do I know? Well, watch that guy. You know, like, or just in my own experience, right? Usually slowly, that's for sure, right? Then he says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up up the past, okay? We have entered the world of the Spirit. Commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So we don't stop at 9. I hear that all the time. Oh, I'm on my 9th step. What do you mean you're on your 9th step? Well, you know, I didn't move forward yet. Okay, well, it says that we're supposed to do this. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up our past. So we can't just, okay, so we have our 9th step and we're going out and making these amends and our list and everything. But we need to continue this thing. Why? Because we've entered the world of the Spirit. Right? Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Next function. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. I talk about this all the time. You know, like, oh, I got to really work on my defects of character. I have to really get rid of fear. I can't get rid of anything. I can only ask God to remove stuff. Because if I'm thinking that I could get rid of something, now I'm thinking I'm God again. And we learned in step 3, first of all, we need to quit playing God. It didn't work. Right? So then we needed to understand that. We would go through this process. Our next, at that point, when we arrived at that point, we needed to let go. But, you know, that expression, let go and let God. Okay, so we had a way of finding a way to do that. Now, once we entered the world of the Spirit, now we have to continue to do that for the rest of our life. Not an overnight matter, for the rest of our life. Continued for our lifetime. So basically, I have to do this until I die. Until whatever higher power there is out there decides Big Book Tim's no longer on the planet. That's it. And that's it, right there. So how do I do that? Okay, I got to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Oh, wow, look at that. That came up. Oh, I'm being selfish. And then I got to go back to like a third step prayer and ask God to remove me from the, you know, like relieve me of the bondage of self. Take away my difficulties because I'm in self again. Oh, my fear. Resentment, dishonesty, those types of things, they come up. I got to ask God. Always God. It always has to be God. Right? Then more instructions. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Okay? Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So here's, you know, on page 20 we saw that if an alcoholic, our constant thought of others may, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others. So now when I'm here, now I'm stuck in selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. So now it tells me I need to immediately discuss them with somebody. So if my sponsor's not available, I can't just sit on them. I got to talk to somebody who understands where I'm at and talk to them about my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, my fear. Get rid of them. I need to talk, right? Make amends quickly. if I've harmed somebody. So then I got to go through that process again. Here, okay, so let's say I have a resentment. Well, what's the cause? What parts of self does it affect? What's my part? What's the nature of my wrong? Now I have to admit that to God and myself. And now I call another human being and go through that process. Now I have to be entirely ready to have God remove that. Now I have to humbly ask God to remove that. Now I have to, oh, did I harm anybody here? Yeah, obviously, if I have a resentment, I harm somebody. Because I'm using them or that feeling to keep myself sick. So, oh, wow, now I got to go to them and write that. Frig, I got to write that down and go and talk to them. Now, if you notice, I said frig, which means obviously I'm not willing to make amends to that person because it needs to be a cheerful choice. I need to be eagerly compliant. So now I have to pray for that willingness to come so I can get into the ninth step. And how do I do that? Oh, okay. Next time I see that person, I have to talk to them and say, here's how I feel. This is what happened. I'm sorry. Is there anything I can do to make that right? And now it's done. And that's the process I have to do for the rest of my life. And my thinking needs to be like that. And then I have to resolutely turn my thoughts to someone we can help. Not me. It doesn't say resolutely turn to how I feel about it. And how, oh, you know, no, who am I going to help now? That's what I have to do. Love and tolerance of others is our code. That's hard. Love and tolerance of others? That's very hard. Especially when you want to punch them in the face. Mm-hmm. Especially around the holiday time, people are constantly, bumping each other, and, oh, I have to get that toy for my kid, and they hit you, and, oh, my God, and now the anger goes. Wow. So I always talk about this. I'm very careful not to pray for patience and tolerance, and certain, you know, because I'm usually given situations where I have to practice patience and tolerance. You know, where I'm in a store, and this is what goes on, and, oh, my God, I'm going to pile drive them. Wait a minute. This is a sick person. I can't be mad. God saved me from being angry. You know, and a lot of times I find myself apologizing to people that don't even know me, you know, or that may not even realize that they did something wrong to me. Oh, I'm sorry. And they give me that look. The hell are you sorry about? You know, like, but I'd much rather, like, have them walking thinking I'm crazy for saying I'm sorry than being rude. I'd rather do that. You know, that's a nice thing. Because then he tells us why. We've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. And here's... Oh, I just love this. I love this next sentence. For by this time, sanity will have returned. What? Sanity will have returned? That can't be. I'll be crazy the rest of my life. I'll always be insane. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. If I'm doing the thinking, the wrong person's doing the thinking. All these things we hear in meetings, all this stuff. Sanity will have returned. Okay, now here come the 10-step promise. That's a promise of the 10-step. Sanity will have returned. What do you mean by that? Okay, we will seldom be interested in liquor. I'll seldomly be interested in liquor? Wait a minute. Am I going to be interested in liquor for the rest of my life? I know a guy, he runs around in meetings and he sits there and he talks. He says, alcohol's my friend. And alcohol will always be my friend. And he runs around talking about he's sober 20 years. You're sober 20 years and alcohol's still your friend? What's wrong with you? Alcohol's not my friend. It was never my friend. It was certainly my master. I thought it was my friend. But because of doing this process, I have a whole different attitude. I had an entire psychic change. This is the result of it. I don't look at alcohol as my friend. I don't look at alcohol as anything anymore. And here's why. Right? If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. So what does that mean? It means I don't have to think the drink through. If I'm thinking the drink through, I'm somewhere where I'm not supposed to be. You want a drink? Nope. It should be that quick for me. If I'm doing this stuff, right? We react sanely and normally. Wait, that's twice now. We react sanely and normally. We can't be normal. We're not sane. Right? But what does step two say? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Okay, so if we entered the world of the spirit, means we have a God. We have a higher power in our life. So obviously, if I believe that, I believe my sanity will be returned. I'll react sanely and normally. I won't be like, oh, I can't have that drink. Let me tell you why. And, you know, and tell you 20 years of my life. And this is what happened. No, react sanely and normally. Would you like a drink? No. Well, why not? You know, I always find it amazing. Like, my experience has always been, I always equate, like, smoking and drinking. It's always funny. Like, nobody ever insists on me having a cigarette with them. You know what I mean? Do you want a cigarette? No, I don't smoke. Oh, okay. Would you like a drink? No, I don't drink. No, you gotta have one with me. Come on, you gotta. You know, I don't trust a man who doesn't drink. Well, nobody's ever said I don't trust a man who doesn't smoke. You know, like, it's amazing that like, alcohol is that insidious. You know, it's that cunning and powerful, baffling, patient and jealous, right? It's there. Oh, and what does this say? We will find that this has happened automatically. Automatically. Which means I don't have anything to do with it. God took care of that for me, right? We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. Once again, I don't have to think to drink through. Right? It just comes with an exclamation point. Oh, wait a minute. What's this say? That is the miracle of it. I've heard that for so many years. Stick around till the miracle happens. Well, what's the miracle? They just told us. The miracle is that my thoughts about alcohol will be completely removed without any effort on my part, without any thought. It just comes. God take care of that for me. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. What? The problem has been removed? That sounds like I'm recovered. It's been removed. Gone. I don't have a problem with alcohol anymore. You know why? Because God's in my life. And God's the one who has all power. So as long as I give it to God, I'm never going to have a problem with alcohol. It's gone. Gone. Miraculously. Poof. No. You think you're cured. No, I don't. I think I'm recovered. I'm recovered. I know if I put alcohol in my body, I'm going to be a mess. I don't have a problem with that. But I'm a recovered alcoholic. God took away any thought. Placed me in a position of neutrality. Safe and protected. Oh, I got to be on guard. No, I don't. I have God in my life. I have not. It says we have not even sworn off. And instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. Oh, my God. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. I say that over and over again. As long as I have God in my life and I'm letting God run my life, that's how I react. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I say that to people and they say, oh, you sound like you're on the track. Oh, you sound like you got this. And I'm like pressured with other people's fear. Keep your fear. Work your steps. Talk to your sponsor. Get a God. Trust your God. I react sanely and normally. Regular drinkers, they don't sit around thinking about this stuff. Would you like a drink? No. Why not? Well, if I drink too much, I get a little crazy. Oh. Sounds like you got a problem. You know, there's never that. It's always, the only time I face any of that kind of stuff is in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. The place where the solution. That's amazing to me. I tell people I'm recovered. I haven't had a drink in almost 20 years. Oh, you think you're safe, huh? Yes! Excuse me. Look, I'm drooling. I'm getting so excited. Frothing.
Frothy emotional appeal.
It'll seldom suffice. Right? Seldom. It might suffice tonight, right there. Right. But this is, you know, I get so excited about this stuff because this is all true in my life. That miracle happened for me. It's happened for me. How could somebody who drank the way I did live my life this way? Because people say that. They meet me. They see me. They talk to me. I can't imagine you having a drinking problem, they say. And I'm like, what? I have phone numbers you could call. Still, they remember. They remember. Almost 20 years and they remember. Ooh. Right? But they don't worry. Those people don't worry about it anymore. Oh, he's fine. He's fine. Oh, you want to... Oh, I forgot, Tim. That's right. You know, whoa, yeah, I remember. You know, they do that. Right? But then he gives a warning, a wonderful warning, because I think this is important, this warning. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And then he tells us what he means by that. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. And here's a little prayer.
How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are the thoughts which must go with us constantly. And then he gives us permission here. We exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Right? We talked about this back in step 3. It's always my will. I can't give it away and take it back. I hear that all the time. I took back my will. When the hell did you give it away? And how did you do it? Because I want to know. If I could take away my will and give it to something else and be a marionette, I'd be fine with that. And be God's marionette, no problem. But it's always my will, so I need to constant. It says, thy will, not mine be done. Thy will, not mine be done. And it says constant, so that has to be running through my head all the time. Constant. Thy will, not mine. Thy will, not mine. That way. And that's how I maintain. That's the maintenance. It's contingent upon that. Right? Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. Wow. All knowledge and power? If we have carefully followed directions, we've begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we've become God-conscious. Wow, we what? We've become God-conscious? We've begun to develop this vital sixth sense. There's that word again, vital, necessary for life. But we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on the matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. Right? And here's another guarantee. 11-step guarantee. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And here they are, instructions. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person? When? At once. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others? Of what we could pack into the stream of life? It doesn't say my stream, it says the stream. But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. Right? More instructions, because I love to do that too. Oh, I did this. No. I'm terrible. Oh. And now I can't sleep, and now, you know, just I just keep going and going and going. I'm useless and blah, blah. All that stuff, all that negative press I love to give myself. Right? And more instructions. After making our review, here's another instruction. We ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. That's pretty simple for me. Hey, God, look, I screwed up. Here's it. Here it is. What can I do about this? Oh, okay. I got to. All right. Yeah, I'll do that. Yep. Got it. And then I go, right? On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Consider. Thinking again, huh? But before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. Oh, what was that? Thinking again? Especially asking that we be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, can we employ our mental faculties with assurance? For after all, God gave us brains to use. Oh, what's this say? Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. It doesn't say our actions and our behavior will be placed on a much higher plane when our actions are cleared of wrong motives. It says our thinking. Our thinking. It starts with our thinking. Every action we have is preceded by a thought. So we're there, and God gave us brains to use. Not our sponsor telling us, oh, don't think. Don't think, don't drink, go to meetings. Okay. My life is miserable. Don't worry about it, just keep coming. No. Start thinking. Get into the steps. Get God. Get busy. We're talking about this today. When I got sober, you know, anybody who's like of my era or older, or maybe even a little younger, will remember the Goya program. You remember that? The Goya, get off your ass? That's what they used to tell me. Oh, you got to get off your ass, then you got a Goya. I don't hear that anymore. Maybe the ass word, I don't know. But, right? In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Oh, wait. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or decision. Right? We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers will come after we've tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind.
Being still inexperienced and having just made a conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We may pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. And I don't know about anybody else, that was certainly me. Right? And I still do that. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. And then here it comes. It says, we come to rely upon it. We rely upon our thinking. Because it's God-conscious. And it's on the plane of inspiration. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be. That we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination, which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Now here is one of the biggest lines in this book right here. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Not wrong and bash them and all this other kind of stuff. Alcoholics Anonymous' opinion are be quick to see where religious people are right. Those people who are ordained, they're right. Be quick to find where they are, right? Make use of what they have to offer, it says. As we go through the day, we pause. I love that. You know, I heard and stole, and I'll keep that and pass it on. For every year that I have sober, I get another second of pause. It's a wonderful thing, right? Oh, when do we pause? When agitated or doubtful. What do? And ask for a right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. Why? We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined. So we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. That last statement, we are alcoholics. Alcoholics are undisciplined. And we let God discipline us in the way we've just outlined. Simple way. Simple. It doesn't say our sponsor. It doesn't say our wife. It doesn't say our significant other. It says God. We're constantly going to God. Constantly, constantly, constantly. That's what the process is about. I say it all the time in meetings, and it annoys people, and I'll continue to say it. Alcoholics Anonymous is about God. It's about God. There's lots of ways of getting sober. This is the one with God in it. I refuse, because I'm responsible. I refuse to let the message be diluted out of this. I may be wrong. Who knows? Could be. I don't care. I'm going to continue to pass this on because it works. It really does. It says it right there. I believe them. The big book says it. I believe it. That's my view. So thank you for putting up with my frothy emotional peel tonight. And hopefully I helped somebody. Thanks.